Welcome to Friday Night Party Line with Jason.
That's me, Internet.
Nelson.
Ahoy, hoy.
Ahoy, hoy to you too, Nelson. I don't think people still say that. And Scott Johnson.
Hey. That was a lie.
Hey.
So, this is episode 66. Forgive me if I'm not all here for this episode. It's been a bit of a long day. The radio station I work at is having pledge drive, and if you've ever even so much as listened to a non-commercial radio station during pledge drive, you know it's bound to be hectic, at least in the background. So we have a pretty good show lined up for you today. It's time for a little bit of a special announcement. In case you haven't noticed, during the introduction portion of the show, I did not mention Chirba. Chirba has been a fantastic co-host for the better part of the last 2 years that I've been doing this show, but unfortunately, he cannot join us today. And that's about it. He's not dead or anything, but it's just sort of sad because he's a great guy. He was called away on other business, but he'll be back again next month, I assure you. Because someone else has got to keep me awake during the show, and it's not going to be me. So we got a slew of topics here for this month. Let's start off with how the news covers tragic events. In today's world of the 24-hour news cycle and to-the-minute reporting, when tragedy strikes, such as the Boston Marathon that happened earlier this month, news organizations jump to cover it in intense detail. But what problems rise from this? And I kind of want to toss this over to Jason, who's our resident journalist in here.
Well, let's not get too serious, Vic, because let's face it, I don't have a huge coverage. I'm not putting out 100,000 issues a week.
Yeah,
I work for hyperlocal, small community newspapers, so we don't really do the whole big, you know, catastrophic tragedies. Although there, I've seen my fair share of shootings, stabbings, fires, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm coming from. But let me ask you this. Why do you think that there's a problem?
Well, I think there may be some problems because often there's some amount of misreporting. Just because the amount of information coming back and forth is going so quick, sometimes things are said on air that, how about this for the biggest example? I think it was the New York Post or a newspaper that put out this right on the front page, a picture of this guy that was completely innocent. And they were saying that the FBI was looking for him.
I'm not going to try to defend the Post,
right?
But that's a little bit outside the scope of your question. That paper had a lot of time to publish that. It was an overnight publication. Yeah. So it's not like they were speaking in the heat of the moment trying to fill 5 hours of canned airtime in the middle of the day.
Right.
It's not a CNN issue.
No.
The Post is bad because the Post is bad. That's all that there is to that. But you don't want to pick up your information and get it from the Post.
No.
I'm reminded of the episode of, what is it, News? The Aaron Sorkin TV show about the news.
Newsroom.
With the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, where everyone's, you know, saying on air, like, oh, she's dead, and they're waiting for second confirmation. I don't think the Post editors or staff have seen that program, and I would recommend it to them, because it seems like they could learn some things from a fake TV show about fake news reporting.
I think some of the rush to get the, like, first headline out leads to a lot of problems. Like, I can't imagine how many different, like, numbers that people would just put out on how many people have died or the, you know, who are we looking for? And, oh, it's this guy or, and that just leads, actually, I see it all in, like, the conspiracy theories that happen later because they're like, oh, well, they had these two people with hats on before. Why are they in all these pictures? And these must be the it. You know, why do we not even care about those people?
I think that one of the big problems with the 24-hour news cycle is that viewers assume automatically that anything that is said on CNN and the spark of the moment is true. Whereas CNN, I think that if you'll look at their reporters who are on the scene, they're 100% ready and willing to admit that they're not telling the truth. They're just telling what they have at the moment. And there's a problem with authority that goes on there. You can't automatically just assume that what is said on CNN is the truth. There's this mindset that in the golden era of Cronkite, everything that was researched and put on television was also true. But I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I think that it's now with social media, with instant access to fact-checking online, with many, many, many competitors all fact-checking each other, that you have more of an ability to tackle the problems that are presented with wrong facts, with hastily prepared facts, with poorly judged statistics, and all that becomes much more transparent because of the 24-hour news cycle. If anything, I think that the 24-hour news cycle is great because it's a peer review. It's a real-time, ongoing peer review of the facts as they develop. And that's a good thing. We didn't really have that before.
That's true.
Yeah, but I mean, if you started watching the news on Boston and then stopped after like the first hour and then like went back a week later and read what really happened, you would be like completely, I mean, everything was completely different. So I mean, like, maybe it kind of does us a disservice that they're reporting on the just the cuff without like actually like taking a couple minutes to just fact check it.
I'm not saying that you're wrong, but let me ask you this. Were you watching the news live as it was unfolding that day?
Yes.
Okay, so there you go. You're feeding the troll, buddy. It's in demand. People want it. People want to be part of the experience of the news as it's unfolding.
Ratings, right?
Experience.
So well, not I just saw ratings, but demand for the ratings. The public wants it. The public wants to be consuming it as fast as possible. So I'm not necessarily sure that the news is so much the problem as it is the symptom.
So you're saying,
you guys,
go ahead, Nelson. Yeah.
Oh, what do you guys think about this whole crowdsourcing thing? Because actually during the Boston happenings, most of the facts I got or, you know, information I got on it came from Reddit, which obviously is not the most reliable source. But
out of curiosity, though, how did those facts hold up?
Relatively well. So there was the beginning push where everyone was, you know, speculating and doing their crappy Reddit stuff. Mm-hmm. And then a few people came in and started making threads with updates that they, you know, they were like, this is only verified information. You know, stop speculating. These are the facts as we know them. And they were faster, it seems, than, you know, major news organizations. But you still, you know, it was something someone posted on the internet, you know, not the 100% professionally verified stuff. But it was good enough for someone who's not there and not personally having to deal with it. Like, for me, it was just, oh, something's happening in Boston. Oh, this is what's happening, you know, hour by hour. Just pure, you know, interest in the story. Rather than, like, I need this information because I'm being shot at. So it was, for the amount that I was affected by it, it was a reliable enough source, I guess. Hmm. You know, it wasn't life or death information that I needed. It was just, hey, what's happening?
Yeah, there was
the nature of news in that manner is entirely voyeuristic anyway, because the number of people who really were affected was probably in the hundreds of thousands, but the number of people who keyed into the news was in the hundreds of millions.
Right. I mean, think of all the people who are listening to the, who weren't affected at all by it, who were listening to the radio scanners of the police department. Now, I was listening to it, but that's because my grandma lives right near Boston, and I want to make sure nothing bad's happening near her, but people all over the world were listening to the radio scanners, listening for the different things and trying to interpret what was going on. It seems like you're right, Jason, that it's the any problems that there may be, or in fact the demand for the news right then and there about what's going on during these tragedies, is a symptom of the audience being, as you said, a little bit voyeuristic and wanting to know more about it in that respect.
Well, it wouldn't exist if there wasn't a demand for it.
It's
just like fast food. McDonald's wouldn't be around if people didn't want to eat that disgusting 1,600-calorie bacon burger.
Yeah.
So you can't really blame McDonald's for meeting the demand.
But if consistently a network is going to constantly make false calls on like what they're reporting, I'm going to go somewhere else. So it kind of is important for them to try to get their facts right. Because, I mean, like, I'm not – when I was saying I was paying attention to the bombing, I wasn't on CNN or whatever. I was reading FARC threads.
Hmm. Please don't interpret this as me sticking up for CNN, because I'm really not. I'm just saying that there's room for interpretation on both sides.
But
if you want to talk about CNN making bad calls, they do it enough. You're not really judging that against how many good calls CNN makes on a routine basis, how many true facts, how many correct facts they get.
Yeah.
So it sticks out like a sore thumb when they say, oh, there's been an arrest when there has been none. At the same time, they've made another 1,000, 1,500 correct calls on facts throughout the day that, you know, they don't really get credit for. The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Right, and when you're under the most scrutiny, that's when people are paying, you know, people are paying the most attention. When you're not under that scrutiny, it, you know, when you're doing your job just as normal, you're doing a good job of it, no one takes notice.
There's something to be said for in cases like the manhunt out in California.
Oh, God.
Recently here.
Yeah.
Where the news media was under, you know, a lot of scrutiny for making updates on Twitter in some cases about where the officers were and what mm-hmm. positions they were taking up, that sort of thing. And to some degree in the Boston case, that the news does need to show restraint. And I'm all for that. Maybe we should take a step back and a little bit of a breather. No problem. We could probably do that. The problem is that there is an arms race going on. And if one network backs down, like NBC did in this case, NBC acted fairly responsibly. That might be just because they didn't have the budget to compete. But NBC acted fairly responsibly, and they got trashed. NBC was left way behind in the ratings. Who among you knows someone who turned to NBC first as the trusted source for up-to-the-minute news on what was happening in Boston?
I don't know. I didn't even turn to TV for the information.
That's the other issue.
Yeah.
Jason, is timeliness I imagine it's not as an important thing as 24-hour cable news, but is there still an element of like needing to get the story out before other newspapers in print?
Well, daily newspapers, if you're talking about those, leaving aside for the moment the weekly news magazine model, mm-hmm. but daily newspapers are all going to get the information out when their press runs every day anyway. You don't change the press time to get a headline out faster. Mm-hmm. It's not like if you have a huge event like Boston, you run a 5 o'clock press time instead of a 10 o'clock press time. It just doesn't happen. It's impossible logistically.
Right.
So that really doesn't play into it. But increasingly, newspapers are going to the web-first model. You push it to the web, because, like it or not, that's where everything's going. And newspapers know that they're a conduit for information and not necessarily, the paper product doesn't matter as much anymore.
Right.
So the war for web space is really where a lot of that comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, when I want to actually look for proper news articles on things, first place I go is Google News, where they, you know, bring together all the different news sources, and I can search by topic or whatever. So online is probably the best place to go to first if you're looking for news, versus expecting your nightly paper. Evening edition of a paper to help you out or anything.
For regional, national, and world news, I go to Twitter first because I follow AP and most of the important stuff is right on the AP Twitter feed.
Although, if we want to talk about AP for a minute here, in case you didn't know, their Twitter account was hacked recently. There was a few fraudulent tweets being put out, and it actually affected the stock market briefly.
That's the power of the fourth estate. But did you see how quickly that stock market plunge reversed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sure. I was actually quite surprised at the speed and acumen with which the AP managed to turn that situation around.
Oh, yeah.
It was a matter of hours and not a matter of days before they had everything sorted.
Mm-hmm.
Who actually hacked them? I don't have all the facts on this case.
I don't know.
I don't know either. Let's just say anonymous.
Anonymous, yeah.
That darn anonymous.
Just default.
Anonymous.
But it is interesting. Yeah. The place that I learned about the Boston bombings first was from our friend Rim over at the Geek Nights podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, me too.
He had it 4 minutes before AP had it up.
Mm-hmm.
that's the tweet that tipped me off that something was going on, and I was sitting in front of my computer watching the AP Newswire at that point, too, the internal service. So not even that had a news update about it.
Right.
But when Rim said, you know, ha, 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 look, this is the future. Twitter is the one to go to for your news, not AP. My response was, yeah, but you know, professional journalists have this little thing that they have to do called verification.
Bah.
Who's bah? Come on. Seriously? No, I mean, I don't think Twitter is going to be the news outlet anytime soon. And by anytime soon, I'll even say in this coming decade. But it is definitely a good alert system. I mean, there was an XKCD comic talking about how people find out about an earthquake over Twitter or through text messages before it'll even reach them. So that is...
Actually, I've found that if I, like, there was an earthquake, a very large earthquake in China, I want to say 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually talking to a friend in China right as it happened. So they were like, oh, there's an earthquake happening right now. And I filed that away and was like, oh, that's cool. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that's happening. And then, like, 48 hours later, I was watching the news on TV, back when I watched the news on TV, and they were reporting it like, oh, this breaking news, there's an earthquake in China. And I thought to myself, this is old news now. Like, this is the age we're living in where 48 hours after something has passed, there's already, you know, something else going on.
Right.
And it was an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, the delay of the delay of news, just to be able to get, like, you know, the right amount, the right information, like, you know, Jason would say verification about, you know, information about it. I mean, if you remember back in 2011, when the Japanese tsunami struck, tsunami and earthquake, I mean, information was coming out of there pretty quickly, but. The new developing information, you wouldn't, if you wanted to know it right away, you wouldn't want to go to like MSNBC or, you know, CNN or whatever. You would want to be watching NHK World News, for example. I mean, to say nothing of the fact that they're right there and then, but, you know, it's the how timely that information is and how quick you want the up-to-date information.
As a kind of counterpoint to that, there's actually I think it's technically a blog called Evening Edition, and they publish in English and French. I think they're from Quebec, where they publish every night the top like five news stories, usually pulled from AP or New York Times or something. And it's a brief, you know, summary and link to a, you know, verified source of the news stories. And they only do like once a day, you know, at like 5 p.m., publish this thing. What is this thing?
Oh, sorry. Okay. Oh, crap. Did I break something? Did I break this?
Maybe. Are we still recording?
Yeah, we're still going.
I should have known. I wish I'd known to warn you about that. We accidentally did that on one of the recordings of Atomic Trivia War recently. Crashed everything.
Oh, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. I better not push the take a picture. But what I did was, for those listening at home, there's a plugin in the Google Hangouts called Capture where it lets you take a picture of the Hangout. I went and I was like, ooh, what does this button do, stupid me? So maybe I'll refrain from taking a picture of the Hangout until the very end. But you were saying, Nelson, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So the Evening Edition came out, and it's pretty high quality. And then another one came out, I think called The Brief, which does the same format but for tech news.
Uh-huh.
And they're great because I think it's because they're delayed. So like you're working and you're doing your thing and you're reading, you know, stuff on the internet about things happening, and then at the end of the day, you know, they publish an RSS feed with the new things. I read it on my iPad, you know, sitting at home. And it's like an end-of-the-day kind of wrap-up. And I kind of like the delayed model, where they purposefully wait and, you know, make sure everything's like the best sources they can get, and then publish. It's interesting.
You know, I think that's actually I think that's an interesting perspective to go about it, because I mean, there. When I was looking, I mean, personal investment in my dear old granny aside, even before the bedlam spread out of Boston and started, you know, spilling into Watertown and stuff, where actually I used to live in Watertown, but when it was still in local Boston area, there is a certain amount of anxiety you get trying to keep up with the newest news, and maybe there is something to be said about getting the more complete picture, but you know, getting it a little later than everyone else and making sure that everything is correct about it.
It definitely impacted my day on Friday when they were looking for then when like the manhunt was going down.
So
I was like glued to the internet instead of actually doing work.
Yeah.
Funny thing is, this kind of business model, or publication model, is basically just newspapers, right?
Basically,
like, but it's such a new and refreshing thing, because it's a, you know, website deciding to go from, you know, up to the minuteness to this kind of more relaxed like schedule.
Yeah.
And it's funny how that's like all the techies, you know, Marco Arment, everyone like that, were tweeting about it. They're like, oh, this is a cool new thing, it's fantastic. And I'm like, well, it's
this cool new thing that's been going on for the past 100 years. Strange.
I feel obliged once more to point out that I wasn't defending CNN.
duly noted. You know, in fact, I think I'm going to make that the episode title: Jason doesn't defend CNN.
No, really, because if you watch their coverage, it really was clown shoes. It's the exact opposite of what Pecora what Nelson was saying. You know, instead of waiting and having those verified sources and having everything, they were out there telling you everything that they could possibly think of. And the problem wasn't necessarily that it was damaging, or necessarily that it was hurting the police investigation, or necessarily that it was sending people the wrong message, or spreading misinformation. Mm. It was that it was so much irrelevant crap thrown in there that it was hard to pick out any relevant detail at all. There's the one lady on CNN who was standing outside, and a convoy of police cars rushed by, and she said, oh, there's smoke. And it turned out to be absolutely nothing, but she freaked out like it was the end of the world, and she needed the camera on her stat because it was exclusive. And she just made herself look like a dumbass.
Because it was probably just the exhaust from the old police cars.
Yeah,
but
right?
She was hoping to be the one who said, I was the one 5 seconds after that development who broke the news. That's making my career.
Now, if we want to talk about how news affects people, what about this notion that perhaps there should be a little bit of self-censorship on the part of the news agencies? Because, I mean, there is a well-known well-done research that when these sort of tragedies occur, it could perhaps spur on the mentally unstable into doing attacks of their own or causing other calamities just because of like, ooh, now's the time.
Well, I think you're right. It's the absolute best policy to play to the lowest common denominator and to dumb everything down and hide our heads in the sand so that no. Nobody can ever be offended or hurt anyone.
That is not what I meant, and you know it.
But that's the end argument, isn't it? Self-censorship, that's what it's all about. Well, what could happen if somebody took it the wrong way and decided to take action on it?
That's
ignorance isn't really bliss.
I know. I suppose that is one way of looking at it, but
it's kind of like that Brown University student that was like they thought was one of the bombers, and he was turned up missing,
and he's dead.
Yeah,
he committed suicide.
Yeah,
but that had to do with speculation that happened on Nelson's favorite website.
Yeah,
I have to stop you there, because apparently it seems that he had been missing and possibly deceased before the whole bombings happened for about a month before.
Oh, is that the one that because they pulled the I saw something on my news feed about a Brown student being pulled out of pulled out of Providence Bay today.
Yeah, that was him.
Okay. All right.
Checking.
Fact checking.
Yeah, I don't know how long he'd been dead. But the speculation over that didn't happen in the news media. It happened online.
The blogosphere and all that.
Right.
Okay, so let's move along, unless any of you have something to add.
Oh, I remember. You know, in the Sandy Hook shooting...
Okay.
When they identified on the news the Twitter feed of the guy, and it turned out to be somebody completely different.
Ooh.
Who had the same name,
yeah,
also from
God.
The same town.
Yeah.
And then they advertised it all over the broadcast, and then you have like a guy going, "Hey, look, it's not me." Like that could damage somebody in the long term.
Yeah.
Big time.
Same.
My dad, actually, he's from southern Italy. He looks almost exactly like Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 bombers.
Yeah.
And so whenever he would get on a plane after 9/11, for about maybe like 8 to 10 years afterwards, he was stopped and, you know, double frisked by the TSA. And he's like, "I'm Italian and an American citizen. What's up?" But yeah.
That's terrible.
People who look similar to famous people, or infamous people, rather, or have similar names. Apparently there's also an anti-Muslim backlash in Boston now, which is not so great.
Yeah. Also, the confusion between Chechnyan and Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Racist will be racist.
Yeah. Also, people who don't know geography. Anyways... it's that time again. Google Glass. Google Glass has recently been released to those who won the If I Had Glass. I don't know if it should be called a contest or not. I don't know. Maybe it was a drawing. But in case you aren't familiar, Google had this thing going on between Google Plus and Twitter that basically what you would do is you would tweet a reason why you should get a Google Glass. And you know, hashtag If I Had Glass, and if you were selected, you go to one of their Google campuses, their Google Plexes, and you pay them $1,500 to get Google Glass. Here's the hitch, though. Once they have it, according to some terms, they can't even loan it to friends. You know, hey, you know, try it for a couple of days. You'll see why I love it so much. For fear that Google would brick the device. They also can't sell it, and apparently can't even give it away. So there's this idea that if you own if you pay for a device, it's yours. You should be able to do with it what you please. So should Google be able to? I don't know if this should be a legal argument or not, but should Google be able to do that? Say, haha, if you loan this to someone, we'll destroy it, basically.
I think that it's not as much of an issue because it is a dev, you know, beta product.
Yeah.
There are similar terms for other kind of closed beta things, but I guess there could be an argument between the right of first sale and these kind of, you know, contractual EULA type obligations. I'm not sure where I stand on it.
I mean, this is hardly a, you know, like a closed developer beta test where it's like if you were in Engadget, right, and you got a device to test out and you had to sign like an NDA and you couldn't talk about it until a certain date because it hadn't been released to the public. These are just, well, for lack of a better word, schmoes that were picked off of Twitter, and... it's not like they got it for free. They paid for
this.
That's the kicker. They paid for this device.
There's end user license agreements on a lot of things that you already pay for. And my understanding is that the legal grounding for them is shaky anyway. Because unless you're a lawyer, the argument almost every time is that there can be no meeting of the minds for someone who's not formally trained in law to sign a legal document like that on the spot in order to get access to a product. even that being said, though, Nelson's right on this one. The Supreme Court just ruled, like, what was it, last week in Kurtzsang versus Wiley about the right of first sale, you know, upholding it. There was the court case where it was ruled that a gentleman could import books from China and resell them in the United States, and it wouldn't violate first sale doctrine. And the way that it was propped up, one of the legs was the legality of first sale being upheld again. So if you buy something, it's yours. And that's what the Supreme Court keeps on saying. It's not like you're leasing your glasses from Google Glass. Exactly. A lease would require a term limit with payment installments. It's not like you're renting it. That would be much the same thing. So if it's yours, it's yours. They shouldn't be able to put restrictions on it. Imagine what would happen if an electronics company, for instance, sold you a flat screen TV, beautiful new 60-inch TV, and said, by the way, we're owned by NBC Universal. You're only allowed to watch Channel 3 on this television. And if you don't, we're going to brick it.
And don't even think about hooking up your computer with it.
Well, I mean, they're trying to do that with similar hardware restrictions. Yeah.
Actually, I believe the Supreme Court just ruled that that's not legal to do with phones either.
Didn't they?
Wasn't the rule that unlocking a phone is perfectly legal?
But wasn't there also recently a bit of legislation passed that made it explicitly that unlocking your phone would be legal, basically modifying the base software of the phone?
I think that has to do more with protections on software, because doesn't it have to do with what's it called? When you have proprietary algorithms and proprietary software that you're not allowed to modify.
Yeah, that's a part of the DMCA.
Right.
Where basically every 6 years, the Library of Congress basically says, these are the things that DMCA does not cover, and they have to renew these exemptions every 6 years because that's the way the law was written, which I personally think is bullshit. I think if they want to have exemptions to it, they should, you know, say that in the law, saying these are the exemptions. If you want to change them, we should amend it, instead of like constantly having to say, oh yeah, you can still do this, you can still do this. And if they don't, like we see with phone unlocking, where they didn't renew the exemption, and then, oh, now it's illegal.
Can you imagine what would happen if books were invented today under our current understanding of law?
Oh, God.
There would be no libraries. You wouldn't be able to lend a book to your friend. And I'm not talking about e-books, just paper books. Mm-hmm. It's a long, long period of precedent that we have that allows for things like libraries to happen.
I think that if...
if I could just go off on a brief tangent on libraries, it wasn't actually until relatively recently, I'm saying within the past 100 years or so, that libraries became what we know of them today. Libraries used to be basically archival locations for the preservation of books, not so much for the lending out and use for patrons. But anyways.
So. Yeah, I think... Here's what I think will happen. When Google Glass comes out for consumers, it will not have these kind of provisions. If it does, then there's a great argument for, you know, first sale against that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Google will do that. I think it's only because it's a somewhat closed beta that they're saying, hey, you know, don't just buy this and then sell it on eBay. I think the language is stronger than it needs to be, solely to prevent things like that. When I worked at a well-known Swiss bank, part of my contract stated that I could not actually tell third parties the name of this well-known Swiss bank. And it just flatly stated that. Although, the reason why they had that in there was in case, like, there was some insider trading thing or, you know, SEC things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like, hey, don't tell your friends who you work for kind of thing. It was more like, if you get sued in, you know, pertaining to the bank, don't, like, blurt out the name of it and, you know, give them evidence against us.
Mm-hmm.
So in a lot of contracts, especially with, like, beta software and NDAs and such, there are a lot of overly restrictive provisions that aren't really enforced that much and only come up in, you know, cases like that. So I'm basically saying it's kind of a weird thing to put in, but it's not super important. It's sort of like when Instagram changed their terms of service, and everyone was like, oh my God, Instagram's stealing our photos. And it's really like giving them the right to copy them onto servers so they can, you know, put them on the internet. Things like that seem really like they're trying to take a lot of rights away, but are needed because of the way our legal system works.
Well, you mean the internet blows things out of proportion?
Sometimes.
I don't know why, but for a second there, I thought you were going to talk about you. I thought you were going to say, you mean the internet blows up vans?
No.
I've seen that GIF.
Yeah.
I know it's true.
Yeah, I talk about this, but I signed something at my work not to talk about this.
But didn't you just?
I love the NDAs that one of the clauses that is that you cannot say that you're under NDA.
Yeah, right?
It's like,
I
don't know. Internet. Yeah, I don't think
test signal.
Too much to worry about.
A self-referential NDA. Huh.
Those exist.
I'm just trying to think of what sort of legal shenanigans you could do with one of those.
You're not allowed to think about the NDA.
You can bend the laws of physics using an NDA.
First rule of NDAs, don't talk about NDAs. Okay, so maybe this whole Google Glass restriction will peter out after it's actually released, which I still really, really want to go and try one.
Hopefully. What if you had an up-to-the-minute news source that put things on your face?
I think we're going to dodge that one for now. All right, so
like speak... delicious pie of information.
Pie.
Info pie.
Speaking about pie, lots of people like pie, but lots of people also like Daft Punk, Firefly, and Star Trek.
That was like the most contrived segue I've ever heard, Nelson.
Are you but, saying you don't like pie?
I love pie, Nelson, but I...
Exactly. How did your fandom develop?
My fandom of pie, continuously eating it. That also describes the development of my gut. So let's move along now and talk about brands and cult followings. So as Nelson alluded to, several different things can have. There are several examples of how brands and people who have generated cult followings. We have Apple, perhaps the most famous. Daft Punk, which is a more recent phenomenon, or rather a more recent resurgence of their cult following. Yeah. Firefly, Star Trek, you know, the whole gamut of the gambit of these things, or whatever the word is. God, my brain.
I believe it's gamut.
Gamut? The T is silent? Okay. The whole gamut of these those types of things. But how do brands and people generate even these cult followings? As a
advertising?
Yeah, but advertising only gets you
promotion.
So far. Also, promotion only gets you so far. I'm talking about something inherent to the thing.
I don't know. I think, like, Daft Punk has a really good, like, promotional system.
But
is there, like, mystery and, like, keeping their faces away from public, it adds to the stuff that we like to look at on the internet, which is like a mystery. Who are these people? What are they doing?
But Daft Punk developed a cult following before the internet.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they did the same stuff.
I honestly don't think it really has much to do with the products at all. Although, just by the nature of things, if you have a good product, it's going to, you know, have more gravity. But at the same time, you need to read the book Cat's Cradle or the book Wampeters and Granfaloons by Kurt Vonnegut. Because basically he says people don't like things because they like things. People like things because they want to belong to the group that likes things. So they create these artificial families so that they can self-identify with other people. It's just a way for lonely people to reach out.
Now that I could definitely say describes the Apple cult, so to speak.
Well, especially since Macs now are basically just Intel machines. with some fancy plastic around them. Mm-hmm. I mean, ever since they started using Intel processors and more generic hardware, it seems like the arguments for why a Mac is better, especially the argument about how they're so much better for graphic design, it has gone out the window.
Yeah, I think back before, like, the iPod and the iPhone, there was, like, a cult following for Apple. I wouldn't really call Apple at this point, like, cultly followed, except for the people that are really, really into it. It's just, you know, I have an iPhone. I hate Apple.
Yeah, I think you should really, as you said, there's a difference between the pre-Intel Apple and, like, the, you know, old beige box kind of PowerPC Apple and the modern, well-known college student Apple. I think the old version of Apple was heavily tied into group self-identifying with kind of like a Northwestern liberal kind of Bay Area thing. And that, you know, includes like teachers and, you know, people like that were really into Apple for a variety of reasons. Like they subsidized, you know, education pricing for their things, and they like did all that stuff.
It was cheap.
It was cheap. And they had really, really good marketing.
Yeah.
Like even look at the 1984 ad. That is targeting liberals, anti-authoritarian, you know, free thinkers.
Gotta
like,
fight the beige box PC, man.
Exactly. And even, like, the modern, you know, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC thing, I don't know how modern it is anymore. When was that, like, 2000?
Yeah, those are, like, the early 2000s.
Oh, jeez.
Like, or the
they're saying,
oh, I was on a computer writing a piece, or I was on the computer writing a paper, and it was like beep 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 beep. Those
the
ads,
bleep, bleep, bleep girl.
Yeah, the bleep 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 girl that looked perpetually high.
But while those ads still target that same demographic and go after that same audience, now they do something that's a little bit insidious, which is to make it a class issue, because it's just the Abercrombie and Fitch. It's just the Audi or the BMW of the computing world.
Yep.
Apple wants to market itself as being for the elite, and that's fine. I understand why they want to do it, but at the same time, I think that we're already inundated a little bit too much with class stuff when it comes to commercialism. You don't have to have a Mac in order to be a good person.
True. I would like to plug a book by Paul Fussell called A Guide Through the American Class System. It is a fantastic book. It's kind of a humorous look at class differences and, like, you know, the difference between, like, upper middle class, lower middle class, upper out of sight versus just the rich, and things like that. And it goes into, it's a little bit dated, but it goes into things like, one of my favorite examples is if you see a person wearing a suit, and as you can see, like, the back kind of has that gap in the back between the suit, like the blazer, what's this called?
Jacket.
The thing? The jacket collar,
yeah,
and your shirt collar. That is called the prol gap. And it denotes an ill-fitting suit when you sit down. Things like that where you can, you know, like if you see a guy wearing an ill-fitting suit, you get a different, like, class picture than if you see a guy in, like, you know, a much fancier suit than mine.
Chances are that they're journalists.
Yeah. Journalists are teachers. Yeah. Or
lazy
Paul
people.
Ryan. I actually think, here's something. I think Paul Ryan, if you saw him in the, you know, during the campaign, he wore ill-fitting suits. Like, every other candidate wore, you know, they're rich people, they're millionaires. They wore, you know, suits that fit them. But Paul Ryan purposefully wore an ill-fitting suit, and I think he did that to appeal to, you know, middle class or lower middle class, working class people.
Mean a sort of subconscious.
Whenever I think of Paul Ryan, I still see those workout pictures that they had in Men's Health. That's all I see when I hear Paul Ryan now.
Oh, man.
wife beaters.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of this this book, The Guide to the American Status System, it talks a lot about how a lot of classes don't have a lot of like class envy. Like if you're upper class, you don't really care. You've got money, you know, it's not a big deal. If you're working class, you still don't really care. You're content with your, you know, what you have. But middle class people have such a huge like class anxiety. They want to be seen as, you know, higher than their station.
Oh yeah.
And, like I have this.
Like, you know, the middle child.
Exactly. It's the same kind of psychological thing.
And that's why hood ornaments and Apple logos are so very important to us all.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a whole study on Priuses and like the social currency or the social status you get in certain areas by having a Prius. And why, like, in these areas, the other hybrids don't sell at all, but only Priuses sell a ton.
Beverly Hills is probably one of those areas.
Yep.
Beverly Hills and Los Angeles in general.
I test drove a Prius in the school parking lot when I was a freshman in high school. I have no idea why my teacher was like, hey, you know, you're 15. Here, have a Prius to drive for like 15 minutes.
What?
It was actually kind of fun.
So, I mean, that's sort of what we're getting at. It's the product or whatever says something about you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you want to go real eco-friendly, you should get a Tesla Roadster.
Well, that just says you're...
Like, I have class envy against people who can afford Tesla Roadsters.
What about the Tesla? What about the Tesla Model S?
That too. That's out of my price range.
I got to test drive one at the Los Angeles showroom. Oh,
nice,
nice.
It's like nails you to the seat. God,
but you can still only go the speed limit, Vic.
Sure. Yeah, but how fast? But the question is, how long does it take you to get to the speed limit?
There you go.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess you know, brands.
What were we talking about again? Oh yeah, brands.
You're talking about brands. Brands. Yeah, cult followings. Right. It's pretty much like we just said. if it can say something about you, like if I know you like Firefly, I know you have good taste in science fiction, and
yeah,
right.
Like us, we. So, like, that tells you something. If you're into Star Trek, well, you know.
The Netflix approach to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how much more you could say about that. That's...
I was hoping...
The difference between those two is that one is intellectual property that has ideas and explores different kind of concepts when it comes to morals and society. And the other is really just something that you buy.
Product
so
branding.
I think commercialism is a lot more vapid on the product end than it necessarily might be on the media end. If you can identify with a book series or a movie that you really love, or watching Archer on FX at 10 p.m. on Thursday nights.
Jason, we're not getting paid for this. You do realize that.
I think there's a little bit more.
I mean, unless you have a deal with FX where I could get a little bit of something for an interstitial. I mean, if you do, let me know.
I'm sorry. It's just the funniest show on TV right now.
True.
I don't know. I'm not
to counterbalance
this. I don't particularly find Archer all that funny.
Oh,
and now you are out.
See, now we know something about his taste, which it's bad, and he's a bad person because of it.
Something interesting that I found: a lot of techie blogs, specifically since we're talking about Apple, Daring Fireball, and people who Gruber's friends with, they don't run ads, but they run like sponsored posts, and so every month or every week they'll have another sponsor, and they'll maybe run like once a day one sponsored post. And it's interesting to see the way that they choose the advertisers. They choose advertisers who they agree with and, you know, they would endorse.
Right, like the Daily Gizwiz on the Twit Network is sponsored by Totino's Pizza Rolls.
Yeah, and it's sort of like they're endorsing this product that they're being paid to endorse, but the decision of, like, you know, it wasn't like in a magazine where the, you know, ad side and the editorial side are completely split. They're, they, as the writer and editor of the blog, or magazine, if you will, endorse certain products that they're paid to endorse. And it's interesting to see how, like, all the people, like, you know, Daring Fireball and Marco Arment's blog and all those people, they really like Squarespace and, like, the 5x5 podcast network. They also run, you know, sponsor things from Squarespace. And they're endorsing it, and it's, like, it's sort of like, it's an in-group thing.
That's fine, like, as long as you don't claim objectivity.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and so, like, I actually read the sponsored posts, you know, or I skim them, because I trust the, you know, I trust their judgment on who they want to be advertising.
Like that, like that episode of Frasier, where, I don't know if you're a fan of Frasier, but he's had a, what is it? He was having a crisis about advertising on his show, and he was decided that if, as long as he likes it, he'll, as long as he actually enjoys it and has tried it, he'll, he's okay with advertising it. And he ended up being put on, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I have a, I've received a missive from Cherba.
Oh, what saith he?
He says, man, being forced to miss FMPL, to quote the man with a fetish for fruit, I am in despair. I'm sorry, my train of thought was completely derailed.
It's fine. Something. It's interesting, like, I'll see an ad for, you know, a sponsored post for Squarespace, and I'll be like, oh, I might want to check that out, because I use, you know, Hover, a domain name management service, also, you know, every once in a while runs sponsored posts in their feeds, and I use them. They're a great service. So I, because, like, it's sort of like, you know, you like this, therefore I recommend this, but while being paid to do so. It's an interesting kind of in-group thing.
It's effective advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's no such thing as cult followings. Everything's promotions and advertisements, exactly. And rah, 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 rah.
I got paid to show Firefly to like 30, 60 people or something like that.
Oh, yeah?
No, I didn't.
Because you know what? I got reward. I did one of those when Windows 7 was first coming out. I signed up for those Windows 7 house parties. So I was basically paid with a free copy of Windows 7 to show people Windows 7 when it was first coming out. So
nice.
It's actually where the heck is it? Here it is. Windows 7 Ultimate Edition signatures with a little signature of Steve Ballmer on it.
Huh. So. It kind of reminds me of Amazon affiliate links.
Okay.
Like, a lot of people, when they're like, oh, I recommend this product, and they put a link to it, and they make it an affiliate link, so they get a little kickback. It sort of reminds me of that, like a social advertising thing. I don't know. It's all groupthink.
Okay.
Anyway, next topic.
Anyways. So the internet, so if you remember a while back, you may recall something called SOPA and PIPA, which was basically if you believe what the internet at large was saying, and I'm mostly on their side with it, would be the end days for the internet, doom and destruction and all we love about this fair medium. And there was a whole lot of brouhaha about it, and there were internet blackouts when you couldn't really use Wikipedia and a whole bunch of other sites. But there's been this thing called CISPA that has made its way through Congress for the most part, and there was barely a whisper about it. And until only recently has there been any sort of movement about it at all. It is just about as dangerous as SOPA and PIPA, but why do you think there hasn't been as much, Now, we're not going to talk about really the things themselves, but why do you think there hasn't been as much coverage of it? I mean, when SOPA and PIPA were trying to go through, Congress was trying to be really hush-hush about it. But CISPA, they've been doing it like, boom, right in the open. So
it's all about fatigue.
Well, it's that, and I think it's also how it's portrayed. Like, CISPA is more about, they're portraying it and talking about it, like about national security and cyber attacks coming from China and Iran. And whereas, like, SOPA and PIPA targeted counterfeit goods and, like your torrent sites and stuff like that. So I think, you know, the way to go about it is Americans are more likely to, you know, let something kind of go if it's about national security.
Yeah,
they don't
it's
want
also,
their internet going down.
Like, SOPA in particular would have done a lot of damage to, the framework of the internet. Like, it was a bad bill. Whereas CISPA, while it might be as bad, it's bad in a privacy way. Like, it won't destroy the internet, but it will not let certain privacy things happen the way they are happening right now.
And Jason, you were saying, you said something about fatigue?
It is about fatigue, I think, largely. There's an inversely proportionate relationship to how complicated an issue is, to how much public steam there is before the public just gives up and throws its hands up in the air. And right now in Ohio, we're gearing up for the May 7th primary races. Small municipal issues, school levies, minor partisan runoffs, and there's not a peep being said about it right now. The reason is that people are so exhausted from the November presidential race, they just don't have the steam to keep going with the primaries, even though there's been a gap of several months. They're just sick of it. And I think it's much the same way with the internet stuff. You had SOPA and PIPA, you had its predecessors. Now there's another one with an obscure acronym that people are just having a hard time finding the energy and emotional investment in. The first two were defeated. Why should we care about the third one?
They're just going to keep doing it over and over and over again. Why bother fight?
And on the other side, on the more positive side, I think that they've seen a good track record that the ACLU has really attacked the couple of them in the past. So I think that they're pretty confident that the ACLU has already declared CISPA to be dead anyway.
Yeah, and you also don't have a lot of the big corporations that were kind of Google and Facebook expressed concern, but they're not like completely against this bill as much as they were SOPA and PIPA because of just how they're written.
Yeah.
I think SOPA and PIPA, too, had the advantage of actually through the methods that they wanted to employ for enforcement of dismantling the actual infrastructure of the internet. And CISPA was more about policy and less about the mechanism by which the internet operates. So there's that huge complication removed from the equation.
Yeah, I mean, and it was. It feels like so long ago, but SOPA and PIPA were, just the way they were worded, it felt like it was going to destroy the internet. But this one seems decidedly more bureaucratic rather
than... Yeah, I'm kind of confused. Like, one of the parts of the bill is that it allows the government to tell a private company when it's under attack from a foreign country. And I'm kind of like, shouldn't they be able to do that already?
Right. Well, actually, I saw this really good, there was this really good segment on NHK World, which I watch pretty freaking often. And they were it was a special feature talking with talks between a Chinese internet security expert, or maybe he was a representative of the Chinese government or something, and someone from the United States. And they were talking about the way, and the United States person was talking about, well, we know that there have been lots of attacks coming from China because of not just where the IP address is, but other types of information, like the way malicious stuff has been, malicious packets have been formed, their payload, the different techniques. It sort of generates a fingerprint when you look at it from a holistic perspective rather than just looking at the source IP of the packets. So I suppose that would be a way that the government could be perhaps, I don't know, better prepared or better qualified to tell an organization that they're being attacked from, you know, country X, as opposed to just a bunch of DDoS attacks from different locations.
It's an interesting perspective because the government has an absolute monopoly on the infrastructure of the CIA, of the FBI, and its other security agencies. But the government doesn't have a monopoly in any way, and in fact really doesn't have a whole ton to do with the infrastructure of the internet. So in order to get out there and find out what's happening and then inform the people who do have influence with the infrastructure of the internet, they would have to share state secrets about intelligence gathering techniques and what intelligence they've gathered. So CISPA might actually have a positive aspect to it in that way, that they can be more open with those, you know, state secrets in order to protect people in real time when it's needed.
Right. Like one of the provisions of CISPA was that organizations would be able to freely share this information with the government. And I think I can sort of envision to take it off on the positive spin that you were saying, that, you know, if an organization was saying, hey, look, we're under attack, we can't determine where it's coming from. Cybersecurity is kind of a big thing in this country. Government, help us out a little bit here. Here's the information. We want to make sure our users stay safe.
Yeah, and if it's used in that way, that's great. The problem is,
if it's not.
Yeah.
You always have to wonder that the ulterior motive is going to be for domestic surveillance.
Yeah.
That seems to be really where the big push is.
Yeah, I mean, particularly after the AT&T debacle like years ago, where they, I guess, had a closet that diverted a whole, that copied basically the data to the government and whatever. so long ago.
Is it companies may give info to the government or companies must? Because as a kind of sometimes rules lawyer in board games, that is a very big difference.
Well, from what this is just a brief write-up that I'm looking at. It says pretty much if the government detects a cyber attack that might take down Facebook or Google, for example, they could notify these companies. At the same time, Facebook or Google could notify the feds if they notice unusual activity on their networks that might suggest a cyber attack. So it seems like it's a voluntary thing.
Yeah, that doesn't sound as bad as it could be.
Right.
The problem is that when it skews into non-threatening situations like copyright violations, should the businesses have access to the full benefits of what the government can hand them? If they're trying to track down somebody who's stealing, I don't know, a half dozen songs?
Yeah.
Yeah. Last thing
Should a company... effectively be able to leverage a warrantless search on your computer because of CISPA?
Can you say that again? Your volume really dipped low.
Sorry. Should a company be effectively able to leverage a warrantless search on your computer or your network or your router just because they suspect that you might be pirating some Metallica songs?
Yeah, that is a potential problemo.
And I think that that's where most of the opponents of CISPA, and specifically the ACLU, are stepping in and saying, wait. Remember those amendment thingies that we've got? Let's revisit those. I think it would be a good idea to revisit those.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is, for example, some of the amendments that they already put in. Companies can only use information they receive for cybersecurity purposes, not to help their businesses. The feds can't hold on to shared data and use it for national security purposes. Later, it does not authorize hacking. Will the incoming cyber data will be handled by Homeland Security Department and the Justice Defense Department. So, I mean, it looks like they've put some amendments in that clarify what only the data can be used for.
Which is good. Restrictions are good.
Effectively, though, this isn't really that big of a deal anyway, because earlier today, the Senate basically said it's not going to pursue CISPA in any way, even though it's passed the House already. And the President's already said he's going to veto it if it comes across his desk. So all involved parties are treating CISPA as dead.
Which means this past, I mean, well, maybe not, but I think it's good to be able to think about why some things make the headlines in terms of the internet circles and why some things don't. Ugh. There we go.
Yeah, I mean, before it was a bigger push by both Republicans and Democrats, because I think there was the media backing to for the, you know, copyrights and trying to prevent piracy. And
yeah,
that's what people were mainly big time concerned with, that it would get pushed through because of all the money involved. I doubt this bill had as many lobbyists trying to push the bill, and, you know, people like my representative Allison Swartz, who lives in Comcast, like headquarters territory, probably doesn't have as strong opinion on it as she did the last time.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that has been a it's been a good show. I'm sorry if I've seemed a little bit out of it, but
you look like you're about to fall asleep.
I am this close. But I've done the show while sick, and I sure as hell aren't gonna. I'm.
I agree. You know, I'm a fan of this show, and if you're a fan of this show, dear listeners, then we are in the same in-group together, and that makes us feel good.
You are a very cool person.
To FNBL, care of Jason Hawk, P.O. Box. No? We're not going to let that happen? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is, if you, yeah, as screw this, I'm done. thanks for coming on the show, guys. I'm losing my mind. It's been a great show. Thank you all for coming back. Jason, it's good to Jason and Scott. It's been great to have you guys back. It's been a long time, but I'm glad you could find the time to come back onto the show. It's good to have a nice spread of interesting people for the audience to feast on your intellectual outputs. So,
well, thanks for having us here.
Okay.
Yeah. kind of a little bit sad that Chirba wasn't here, because he laid the smack down with a couple of not too thinly veiled insults in the past few weeks.
Yeah, you're his he likes to mess with you, Jason. Actually, yeah. I got a message just a few just a minute ago saying that he's regretting he should have recorded a clip of himself saying, "I'm not here, this is a recording," to insert during the intros just to fuck with people.
You know what we should do?
What?
Soundboard.
Oh. You know, that wouldn't be hard to do. Oh no, I'm getting an evil thought here. So thanks for coming back on the show, guys. This has been a great, like I said, this has been a great episode of Friday Night Party Line, episode 66. And we hope to have you on again soon. Good night, everybody. Okay, and we're done.
Yay. Only 600 more, and then we can raise the ancient spirits, the ancient ones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that worked out somewhat perfectly, because I need to go host Atomic Trivia War now.
Ooh, yeah. Fun.
It's that time. 8:30 is the witching hour.
Any other time, I would have asked if I could pop on too, but I don't think I'm mentally equipped to deal with 9,000. But to say hi to Ro and Omar for me.
Yeah. Very good.
All right.
All right. See you guys, Jason. Later.
See you guys.
Yeah.
Nelson, I got to talk to you, man. Remember when Hurricane Sandy or something, that you were saying your phone was making all sort of hellish noises warning you to stay inside?
Oh, yeah.
My phone did that recently.
What happened?
Well, nothing happened. I had set it up on the I'd set it up to alert me even when the system was doing a test. And I'm sitting at my table here, and suddenly this thing starts making an unearthly noise. And I'm looking at him, oh my god, what the fuck is this? And saying, like, this is a test. And so I was talking, he's like, this is a test of the whatever system. And I suddenly had a moment of realization. I'm like, oh, that must be what Nelson was talking about.
Where do I turn on that?
Well, you use an iPhone, right?
Yeah.
I have no idea, but if you're using Android, I could tell you pretty much exactly.
It's actually automatically enabled on iPhone, or at least
it's not. I've never gotten a emergency broadcast. I mean, I guess I live a charmed life.
Yeah,
disasters happen.
Let's see here. Yeah, so for Android, it's under cell broadcast, and it's like, yeah, show. You have options. You can say show extreme threats, severe threats, amber threats.
Man, I only want critical
threats. I only want to know if there's a meteor coming at me.
Here we go.
Display test broadcast for earthquake tsunami warning system. Test broadcast for this commercial mobile alert system. And the thing is that there's a type of alert that's called a presidential alert.
Oh, man.
Yeah, if the president needs to say something like, I'm assuming that this is sort of like an alert,
hey guys,
like,
vote for me. No.
No, I'm thinking that these are alerts along the scale of, there's a nuke coming.
You may want to. Hey guys, duck and cover.
Duck and cover, basically.
So in iOS, it's under settings, notifications, and then you scroll all the way down, and then it has government alerts, and there's amber alerts and emergency alerts.
Yeah. I get emails.
So I guess you can actually turn it on and off, but I like it because it's local, and it's actually, whoever thought of it is a smart dude.
He's a genius, man.
Yeah, because, like, I don't care about alerts in other places. I'll, you know, go on Reddit and look at the news or whatever. But
oh shit, I should have brought this up.
What?
Motherfucker. in the news portion of it, I should have brought this up. God damn it. Oh well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh well.
But yeah, but I, like, if something's happening in New York City, Bloomberg is like, hey bro, what's happening in New York City? You should, you know, do something about it. And I'm like, that's cool, bro. That's pretty much my whole
story.
Cool,
bro.
Cool alert, bro.